From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, Brazil's Operation Car Wash. Over the past 5 years, investigators in Brazil have been conducting one of the most sweeping corruption probes in the country's history. The case has led to indictments against some powerful government officials, including former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The investigation is known popularly as Operation Car Wash.
It's been described as the world's biggest corruption scandal, involving more than $5 billion worth of illegal payments.
At the outset, many Brazil watchers hailed the investigation as an institutional advance for Brazilian democracy, which had long grappled with corruption, though critics feared political bias. In mid-June, leaked messages published by The Intercept called into question the investigation's fairness and its future.
How blind is justice in Brazil? The Justice Minister, Sergio Moro, in the hot seat in the wake of leaked messages and audio tapes that show the then-crusading anti-corruption magistrate conspiring with prosecutors to hasten their case.
Our guest this week is Brian Winter, the editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly and a former foreign correspondent in Latin America. Winter has written widely about the car wash investigation, and he's also interviewed Sergio Moro, the judge at the center of the new leaks. Hi, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
So we actually spoke some months back just before Jair Bolsonaro won the election in Brazil, and we looked a little bit at an investigation known as Car Wash, Operation Car Wash. So in the first weeks of June, The Intercept ran explosive coverage exposing what looked like improprieties in the corruption investigation. Can you explain to us simply what Car Wash was?
Yeah, so the car wash story goes all the way back to 2014, which seems kind of like ancient history given everything that's happened in Brazil since. But it started with federal police who found a money laundering operation that was being run out of a gas station in Brasilia. This in itself was not that uncommon, but they started kind of pulling on the string and they discovered that it was actually part of a much broader here words fail me a little bit because of the scope of this thing. I mean, basically, this was a scheme that was connected to a huge percentage of the Brazilian economy, including big infrastructure companies, the state-run oil company, Petrobras, and more. And since then, you've seen more than 100 convictions. You've seen more than $10 billion in fines and nearly $1 billion in frozen assets. It's a corruption case that has stretched across multiple countries and continents, with implications for some countries in sub-Saharan Africa, as well as the rest of Latin America. Talking about it now in 2019 almost feels a little bit like playing an old greatest hits album, because the story has kind of been out there for a while, and things lately have gotten more complicated.
Part of the reason that Bolsonaro rose to power so quickly and so surprisingly was that he ran on an anti-corruption campaign.
That's exactly right. And you can draw a direct line between the prosecution of car wash and the fact that it implicated almost all of Brazil's traditional political parties, including the Workers' Party, which ran Brazil for 13 years from 2003 to 2016. You know, at first in Brazilian society, there was a lot of rage that was mostly concentrated against the Workers' Party. But then as the revelation spread and as it became clear that basically everybody or almost everybody in Brazil who was in politics was feeding from this trough, it became a generalized anger against politicians across the board. And so what Brazilians then did in the 2018 election was they voted for essentially the candidate who was most unlike all of those traditional politicians that they could find, and that was Jair Bolsonaro.
But actually, the Workers' Party candidate Lula was still incredibly popular, but he was rendered ineligible to run.
Right. So Lula, as you note, he left office in 2010 with an approval rating of nearly 90%. He was one of the world's most popular politicians. That then fell as the economy fell apart in later years, in large part because of mistakes that he and especially his successor, Dilma Rousseff, made. At the same time, by the time we got to the 2018 election, and so many other people had been and other parties had been tainted, there was a significant percentage of the population, in fact, really according to polls, a majority, that looked at Lula and said, you know, he may have been corrupt, but things were good when he was in office. And more to the point, I don't know that he was any more corrupt than any of the other politicians out there. And so kind of a combination of, let's call it, relativizing whatever sins he may have committed, combined with the positive memory of the 2000s, which was just a great period for Brazil across the board, caused his support to be very high. And in fact, most polls indicate that had he been allowed to run as a candidate instead of being in jail, he might have won.
And what sent him to jail exactly?
So there are several cases against Lula, all of them in connection with car wash. The one that sent him to jail involved the renovation of a beachfront apartment that prosecutors said was essentially intended for him. And it was basically, it was $3 million reais, which is roughly $1 million worth of renovations that were allegedly done by a construction company as returning the favor to Lula for things that he had done for them. And, you know, Judge Sergio Moro found Lula guilty on this count. An appeals court then unanimously found him guilty and actually increased the sentence. And then there were some appeals that kind of related appeals that all went against Lula.
Was it perceived as political at the time, his prosecution and his incarceration?
Yes. Now here we've arrived at the essence of the question, and this is where we have some new information. There was always suspicion that the first judge in this case against Lula, Judge Sergio Moro, who is now Bolsonaro's justice minister, that he was at the very least tougher on Lula than he had been on other defendants. And this is where things get incredibly complex, because it's also true, as I noted earlier, that there have been more than 100 convictions relating from the car wash case. If you look at the range of politicians and people who were sent to jail from a variety of political parties, it is, in my belief, impossible to argue that car wash was exclusively out to get the Workers' Party or Lula. It just doesn't stand up to scrutiny. You had politicians, you had people from the private sector over the course of several years who all went to jail. But the question of whether they were extra aggressive or whether they bent or broke rules of judicial procedure and or ethics in order to sentence Lula, who they clearly believed and stated publicly they believed was the ringleader of this entire scheme, you know, that has been a doubt that has lingered in the minds of people for years. And this evidence, these transcripts that were leaked as part of by Glenn Greenwald and The Intercept, suggest strongly that there was misconduct and that the judge and the prosecutors were communicating in an effort to make sure the case was as solid as it could be.
Let's get to those transcripts in just a moment. I'm curious if you can just unpack a little bit more about who Sergio Moro was and the town he was from, which became known for this investigation.
You know, Sergio Moro is, or I should say was, a judge in a mid-sized Brazilian city called Curitiba. He had specialized over the years in hearing cases involving retirees. He was actually known as the pensioner's judge. And he also looked a lot at money laundering cases. And this is why this case first came to him. And then over the course of several years, the prosecutors who were working in this same city pursued the case. Moro guided it in a way that kept the case in Curitiba as opposed to letting it go to a bigger city. And as a result, it was a little bit like watching a small group of prosecutors in Cincinnati take down a huge part of the political system in Washington.
Was he perceived as politically motivated himself at the time?
I have spent time with Judge Moro, or former Judge Moro, over the years. I've gotten to know him pretty well. And you know, this is the part that all of us have been wrestling with in the wake of these revelations over the last couple of days. Let me talk in general terms for just a moment. In the prosecution of big cases throughout history, whether you go back to, you know, when the trusts were busted in the United States 100 years ago, or you look at Prohibition era stuff in the 1930s, or when mafia families of New York were busted, in the 1970s and 80s, it was fairly common for prosecutors to bend and in some cases break rules of procedure and aspects of the law in the name of busting the case. Those were not necessarily political motivations. And I think if you look at Judge Morrow and also the team of prosecutors that was, you know, also working on the case, I don't believe that he was out to get Lula or the Workers' Party for, like, because he hated the left or because he hated Lula in particular. What I do think we've seen with the revelation of these transcripts is that these guys, for reasons of basically prosecutorial logic, were bending the rules and doing the things that they should not have been doing because they were in pursuit of a guy who they believed was the figurehead of a criminal organization.
But again, Morrow was perceived as heroic in the thick of this.
He was perceived as heroic. They've done polling since these leaks come out, and people are still standing by him. But it's tough. I mean, I have been someone who, over the years, has defended car wash and this anti-corruption push generally, because, you know, we all know what corruption does to countries. We all know that it erodes faith in institutions and in democracy and takes away money that should be used for healthcare and education. I've followed Latin America and I've lived there for 10 of the last 20 years, and all of us know what a terrible curse impunity is in these countries, the sense that there's one set of rules for very powerful people and another set of rules for another. And so seeing some of these extremely powerful, previously untouchable figures held to account for what they've done has been positive. But look, I mean, none of what I'm saying here is intended to justify this conduct and these practices that have been revealed by these leaks. And by the way, we already had indications prior to the Intercept report that these prosecutors and the judge in Curitiba were willing to stretch or even break established rules of procedure in order to get their man.
So actually, let's unpack it, because we keep sort of dancing around what actually The Intercept revealed. What did The Intercept show that we didn't know before?
Yeah, I mean, basically two categories of things. One is procedural. And specifically, and there were lots of things in these reports because they have, I mean, Glenn Greenwald has said that the amount of information they've received actually dwarfs in sort of quantity of bytes what they received in the Snowden case back in 2013, which, I mean, that tells you how big this leak is, right? And the most damning stuff has been the transcripts of interactions between Judge Morrow and what was essentially the lead prosecutor of the group that was pursuing this case, coordinating things like the order of so-called phases, the tactical decisions of when to pursue certain elements of the case, which, according to Brazilian penal code, as I've got it in front of me right here, it says that the judge is considered suspect in a case when he has advised either the prosecution or the defense in a case. So that's kind of the first category of sin here, if you will. The second category, which is a little slippery from a legal perspective, but is damning from a perception perspective, is, you know, the tone of some of these messages. And in one of them, Judge Morrow says to the prosecutor, Deltan Delagnol, he says, well, now that the defense, meaning Lula's defense, has had their little show, a little show is an exact quote, now I'm paraphrasing the rest, now it's time for you guys to go out and tell your side of the story. Their little show, showzinho in Portuguese, I just don't think there's any way that a reasonable person could look at that transcript and come away thinking that this was an impartial judge. I know that Moro has argued to the contrary, both in public and in private conversations, and has pointed to his fairness in a variety of other rulings. But, you know, a transcript is a transcript. And lots of people around the region and in Brazil have been disappointed with him as a result.
Sergio Moro had already come under fire for joining the Bolsonaro government.
Right. So in October or November of last year, Moro, who was still a federal judge at the time, was offered the justice ministry with expanded powers in the Bolsonaro government, which then took office on New Year's Day. Many saw in that proof that Moro had been political all along and kind of favoring one side or the other. And they described that his decision to accept this job, they saw it as a prize, right? Like a reward for a job well done from the politician who had benefited the most from his work. I have to say, I disagree with that narrative, in part because of at the time and in months since, I spoke with Judge Moro about it and saw his conversations, you know, what kind of what he said publicly. So Moro has always been inspired by and has the Mani Pulite scandal that broke out in Italy in the early 1990s. And I won't dwell too much on the details of that one, but basically it was similar in many ways to what I've described here with car wash.
That's the Clean Hands investigation.
That's the Clean Hands investigation. And it resulted in the indictment of several hundred Italian politicians and was hailed at the time as an opportunity to reduce the corruption that had always been endemic in Italy. The problem was that 10 years, 20 years later, the general view was that Mani Pulite, for all the noise that it created, it did not lead to a reduction in corruption in Italy. In fact, all it really demonstrably led to was the election of Silvio Berlusconi. And of course, there's echoes here with Brazil as well. Now, Moro knew this, and his logic, at least what he told people, including me at the time, was that he was taking this job at the Justice Ministry so he could then use his influence and the political power of that position to pass reforms that would actually lead corruption in Brazil to be reduced over time. Things like giving investigators more power, doing more regulation of campaign finance, kind of the things that would actually result in structural improvements rather than trying to just kind of, you know, battle the symptoms from the bench. But on the other hand, I recognize that these leaks and the tone that he had and the things that he did in these transcripts reinforce this narrative that others had, that it was political all along.
Have you been in Brazil since Bolsonaro was elected?
Yes, I was there most recently in March.
And what is the feeling on the ground at that point before this leak?
Well, I mean, if you look at polls, and you don't have to go back to March. I mean, they've done polling on car wash since these leaks came out. So far, what we see is that Moro's approval rating has come down from about 60% to 50%. On the one hand, you could look at that and say that the equivalent of 20 million Brazilians turned against him as a result of these leaks. You could also look at it and say that he's still, by most measures, the most popular political figure in the country. Because let's be honest, there are people in Brazil who either don't understand or don't particularly care about the nature of these leaks. What they care about is that Lula and a bunch of other allegedly corrupt politicians are in jail. And as a matter of fact, even more than that, people say, okay, well, if Moro and these prosecutors had broke the law, I'm rendering another person's point of view here, right? Then that's okay, because the ends justify the means.
Obviously, the content of the messages, the tone of the messages are part of what's scandalous about them. Do you think the opinions that are expressed within that tone invalidate the investigation?
So that's a great question. In many respects, it's the question. I think it's one for Brazilian jurists. What I understand is that there's a decent chance that this particular conviction against Lula might be overturned as a result of these revelations. Now, it's worth mentioning a couple things. One, none of the transcripts so far indicate anything quite as severe as, you know, falsification of evidence or anything like that. But it's also worth noting that there are five other cases active against Lula, including kind of outside the umbrella of car wash. But, you know, I'm not sure how much it matters, because public opinion has always been an important part of this story, going all the way back to 2014. Without public support, the car wash case probably would have been sabotaged or at the very least reined in very early on. It was the fact that there was kind of this universally positive or almost universally positive sentiment around Moro and what was going on in the city of Curitiba at the beginning that basically deterred politicians in Congress and elsewhere in the Brazilian kind of official structure from doing things like, for example, curtailing police's investigative powers or changing a rule that means that people have to go to jail if their first appeal of a decision is rejected. These are hugely important things that are the difference between people being in jail or not. And there have been efforts over the years, really constant efforts by the powers that be, to sabotage this investigation. And the concern now is that given these leaks, these politicians and others might be able to take steps that will set back the whole anti-corruption drive as a whole, meaning that these things that have been revealed will end up undercutting the work of prosecutors all over Brazil. And it's part of this kind of bigger story where basically, as democracy has spread in Latin America since the 1980s, as judicial institutions developed and became more independent, you saw this bold new generation of prosecutors who were pushing forward these cases. You also saw, starting in the 2000s, Latin America's middle class expanded by some 50 million people, and kind of social values changed as well. Corruption became a top concern, whereas before people were more worried about hand-to-mouth issues like unemployment and hunger. Polls have shown over the last 10 years or so that corruption is now, it's actually the number one public concern in Colombia, and it is number two in Brazil, Peru, Bolivia, and Mexico. So these are huge kind of social changes in attitudes that have been taking place against all this. The question is whether this broader anti-corruption push can survive the revelation of these mistakes and abuses that we've seen in the car wash case.
Back in September 2016 in America's Quarterly, you wrote, "The intense pressures of investigating and jailing dozens of Brazil's most powerful figures, plus their near deification by local and international media, including this magazine, were bound to eventually result in hubris and mistakes." Are we now seeing the fruit of that hubris and mistakes?
Yeah, so what that tells you is, even by September 2016, I had some doubts about where things were headed and what we were seeing. And these transcripts, many of them are actually from that era. These guys were under extreme pressure. They also had, you know, they had the entire political class against them. And again, when I'm saying these things, I am not, explicitly not, trying to justify what they did. But they were taking on the entire political class. They believed that if they had just sat there in Curitiba and quietly done their work and not spoken to the press, basically if they'd adopted a Bob Mueller-type approach, if you will, that basically the public would not be aware of what they're doing, would not support them, and therefore their investigation would not succeed.
Is car wash dividing Brazilian society?
What we've seen now is, since the revelation of these transcripts, is things are kind of breaking down along very polarized lines. Essentially, people who are supporting the Bolsonaro government, which, you know, he has a hard core of about 35% of society right now. You then have another 40% of Brazilians who have said in polls that they believe that these revelations cast intensified doubt upon the investigations. And then 30% who kind of shrug their shoulders and say they don't really know.
How do you think that this era of Brazilian politics will now be remembered by history?
Oh, if I knew. I mean, history is being rewritten right now. And many who had previously expressed little but admiration for the work of the car wash people are now seeing things in many more shades of gray. I think where it heads, it depends on the revelations that are still to come. And frankly, I think it depends on what the rest of the Brazilian judicial system does. Will whatever mistakes that Moro and the prosecutors made be punished? What will happen to Lula's case? If it all gets swept under the rug, that's damaging too. So, very complicated times ahead. And look, a very difficult period for Brazil overall. It's a country that has been kind of lost for the better part of really 6 years now, since protests first broke out on the eve of the World Cup in 2013. The economy's been flat. There's been an absence of political consensus. It's been tough. Poverty's gone up. Inequality has risen. So it's a country that's somewhat adrift right now and complicated as well.
Brian Winter, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this.
All right, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Brian Winter, editor-in-chief of America's Quarterly. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with Benjamin Soloway and Maya Gandhi. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. We'll be back next Friday. Thanks for listening.